Good morning. The Supreme Court seems likely to let President Trump fire independent regulators for any reason. What did the justices say about the limits of presidential power? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump says he's going to use the money collected from tariffs to pay farmers who have been hurt by tariffs. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. We'll hear from Louisiana farmers saying rising health care costs are another major concern. Also, what is Trump's version of the Monroe Doctrine? And most Democrats are frustrated with their party. Senator Chris Van Hollen tells me what he sees as the path forward. It's Tuesday, December 9th. On this day in 1979, smallpox was officially eradicated about a decade after global vaccination efforts. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says he's going to let the U.S.-based chip maker NVIDIA sell one of its most advanced microchips to China. The chips are used in artificial intelligence. NPR's John Ruwitz reports the policy shift comes amid worries about U.S. leadership in the AI sector.
Trump says on social media the U.S. will allow NVIDIA to sell H200s to approved customers in China, quote, under conditions that allow for continued strong national security. He says he told Chinese leader Xi Jinping about it, and she responded positively. Trump also indicates that the U.S. would get a cut of sales. The H200 is what's known as a GPU chip. It hit the market last year, and it's better than its predecessor, the H100 model, which has been a workhorse of AI data centers. NVIDIA's best chips, the Blackwell series, are not part of this deal. The U.S. has imposed a virtual embargo on cutting-edge chips and chip-making equipment going to China out of fear that the U.S. could lose its lead in the AI race. John Ruwitz, NPR News.
Media company Paramount is mounting a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers Discovery. Paramount is launching the effort with a lot of foreign money. NPR's Maria Aspen reports Saudi Arabia and China are involved in the Hollywood drama, and so is President Trump's son-in-law.
Paramount is taking on Netflix, which last week agreed to buy some of Warner Brothers' businesses. Paramount wants to control all of them and is offering Warner Brothers shareholders a deal worth $108 billion. Paramount is also controlled by Larry Ellison, one of the world's richest people, and his son David. But they're not putting up all the cash themselves. Instead, they've lined up money from the governments of Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, and Qatar. Another investor has ties to China, and another was founded by President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Paramount says that if its hostile takeover succeeds, the Middle Eastern governments and Kushner's firm would not be involved in running Warner Brothers. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
Texas Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett is running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate in her state. The seat is held by Texas Republican John Cornyn. Crockett is considered an outspoken communicator who has frequently clashed with Republicans. She was first elected to the House of Representatives in 2022.
There are a lot of people that said, you got to stay in the House. We need our voice. We need you there. And I understand. But what we need is for me to have a bigger voice.
If elected, Crockett would become the first black woman to win a statewide office in Texas. Voters in Miami are choosing a new mayor today. Republicans are supporting former city manager Emilio Gonzalez. Democrats are backing former county commissioner Eileen Higgins. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A few thousand residents near Anchorage, Alaska, don't have power after potent winds scoured the area over the weekend. Some wind gusts have reached hurricane strength for 3 days. Farther south, the National Weather Service issued cold weather advisories around Alaska's capital, Juneau. Temperatures have fallen below zero. The ceremony for the Nobel Peace Prize is soon, but it's not clear if the winner, Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, will be there in Oslo, Norway. Julie Carneiro reports she has been in hiding.
Maria Corina Machado's mother has been praying the rosary every day, asking for her daughter to make it to Oslo, as she told the AFP upon arriving at the airport. Other members of Machado's family are in Oslo, too, and the top brass of South America's right wing are coming. Presidents Javier Milei from Argentina, Daniel Noboa of Ecuador, and Santiago Peña of Paraguay. Machado is expected to give a press conference on Tuesday, But Venezuela's attorney general said she would be considered a fugitive if she left Venezuela, where the regime accuses her of conspiracy and inciting terrorism. Machado is the main challenger of Nicolás Maduro's lengthy rule in Venezuela and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her fight for democracy. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro.
Astronaut Johnny Kim has returned safely from space along with two Russian cosmonauts. They touched down in Kazakhstan today after spending 8 months aboard the International Space Station. Kim served as a Navy SEAL and earned his medical degree from Harvard. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
August 1942, Ruth Tambara and her husband Earl arrived in St. Paul, Minnesota, with the clothes on their backs and little else. However you looked at it, they'd essentially been evicted from their home, their jobs, their lives in Berkeley, California, because they were Americans of Japanese descent, which after Pearl Harbor instantly landed them on the government's list of potential enemies of the state. While most West Coast Japanese Americans were being herded into internment camps so the government could keep an eye on them, the Tambaras and other families were relocated to the Midwest, courtesy of the War Relocation Authority. The couple found lodging with a St. Paul friend, and Ruth, as part of the deal with the Relocation Authority, gave talks to local groups about Japanese Americans. She and her husband Earl also worked tirelessly to help others like them relocate to Minnesota and to resume their educations and careers that had been terminated by anti-Japanese discrimination. In 1943, the Tambaras bought a house in St. Paul, a city Ruth still called home in 2008 when she died, age 100.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court appears likely to hand President Trump another major victory.
Yeah, the court heard arguments Monday over whether the president should have the power to remove members of independent agencies despite laws that say he cannot. The conservative majority indicated they thought he should.
NPR's Andrea Hsu is listening to the arguments and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's back up first and just talk about this case, which involved the firing of a Federal Trade Commissioner who then sued the Trump administration to challenge her firing. But it's not about just that, right, Andrea? What's at stake here?
Yeah, well, the FTC is one of a couple dozen government agencies that share a similar structure. You know, these are regulatory agencies, typically with three or more members representing both parties who are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And Congress dictated that the president can only fire members for cause for things like neglect of duty or malfeasance. And Amit Agarwal was representing the fired FTC commissioner in court. He argued the setup has a long history dating back to the beginning of the republic.
Presidents have understood and appreciated that vital interests of the American people can be served by having constraints on the exercise of power. That is a really important part of our constitutional tradition.
Okay, but it sounds like the conservative justices didn't buy that historical argument.
That's right. They seem concerned that the separation of powers has gotten murky. You know, it seems like everyone agreed that independent agencies like the FTC and many others are not purely executive in function. Their board members and commissioners make rules and decide cases. Their actions affect people and businesses all over the country. And Solicitor General John Sauer, who was representing the Trump administration, argued that's why it's a problem that they're not accountable to the president.
That's a power vacuum. The president is answerable to the voters. They have no boss. The point is that power vacuum should not exist in our constitutional structure.
What did the liberal justices have to say about this?
Well, Leila, they took the opposite view of pretty much the same facts. Let's listen to Justice Kagan.
Isn't it problematic that what this is going to amount to is putting not only all executive power in the president, but an incredible amount of legislative slash rulemaking power and judging.
And Justice Sotomayor said that the administration is asking the court to destroy the very structure of government and take away from Congress this idea that some agencies are better off independent. Of course, Leila, you know, with the current makeup of the court, it's hard to see how that independence will stand. And in fact, Thomas Berry with the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, says he is really confident the court will overturn the 90-year-old precedent that limited the president's power of removal. And he spoke with NPR just after the arguments.
The only real question left is how are they going to write this opinion? How broad is it going to be? What reasoning are they going to use? And to what extent, if any, will they address other contested issues?
And I know one of those issues is the Federal Reserve, right?
Yeah, and the court is going to be tackling a whole different case about that next month. But yesterday, Solicitor General Sauer did quote the court's own shadow docket order that called the Fed a quasi-private, uniquely structured entity with a distinct history. You know, whether the conservative majority shifts their thinking on that after next month's arguments, that remains to be seen. But for the moment, the Fed aside, it seems the court is prepared to give the president a lot more control over agencies that traditionally were independent.
NPR's Andrea Hsu. Thank you for your reporting, Andrea.
Thanks for having me.
All right, for more on this case, we turn now to Amy Howe. She's a reporter with SCOTUS blog and was at the court for arguments on Monday. So, Amy, was there a particular exchange that sounded most telling to you about how the court might eventually rule?
One of the exchanges, or lack of exchange, was actually really telling, which is that there was almost no discussion about a question that the justices, when they agreed to take up this case, specifically instructed the litigants to tackle, which is the remedy. If the court were to uphold the removal provision and say that Trump's powers are restricted, what is the remedy for someone who is wrongfully fired? Do federal courts have the power to put that person back in office, or does that person, like Rebecca Slaughter, only get back pay? And there was basically no discussion of that, which you would expect if the court thought that there were a chance that it might ultimately uphold these removal restrictions. Justice Kavanaugh told John Sauer, the Solicitor General, that he had real concerns about this question. But then he said, but we don't need to get into that if we rule for you, meaning the Trump administration.
Were the conservatives on the court concerned about anything in particular in their questioning yesterday?
So both sides, you know, what they were really concerned about, as Andrea's discussion suggested, was the limits of the arguments that both sides were advancing. You know, and I think that those were the strongest arguments on each side. We're pointing to the potential consequences of a ruling for the other side. Rebecca Slaughter's lawyer, you know, talked about the risks not only for the FTC, but also other independent multi-member agencies that she said Congress wanted to insulate from partisanship. But on the other hand, the justices were concerned that if Rebecca Slaughter were to prevail, Congress could take large swaths of the executive branch outside of the president's control by turning agent departments like the Department of Education or the Department of Interior into these independent multi-member agencies that would be insulated from presidential control.
So, Amy, just so I understand it, is the choice you're telling me about giving Congress a lot of power versus giving the president a lot of power?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And, you know, when it comes to the separation of powers, you know, this seems like a case in which they are more comfortable giving the president that power, but perhaps carving out some particular parts that might otherwise be affected, like the Federal Reserve.
Now, under some of the theories from the justices, does every federal worker and appointee serve at the pleasure of the president?
That is one of the sort of central questions in this case. The Trump administration and some of the justices are sympathetic to this theory known as the unitary executive theory, which is the idea that the president has complete control under the Constitution over the executive branch. And they say that should include the power to remove members of the executive branch so that the president can carry out his duties and put his policies into place.
And I guess that's part of the argument, right? That no one that works with the federal government is completely bias-free. So the federal government should be allowed at that time to appoint anyone they feel is aligned with their beliefs.
To appoint and certainly to remove.
Yeah. Now, we heard from one analyst a few minutes ago saying that the biggest question is how broadly the court rules. What are some of the options the court has here?
So Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Alito both suggested that the court could write a relatively narrow ruling that carves out someone like an institution like the Fed. And then there are also some sticky questions relating to various federal courts like the tax court and the Court of Federal Claims, in which the judges don't have life tenure and there are similar removal restrictions. And so that could be one of the options, is to say that when you're talking about an agency like the FTC and other similar agencies that exercise what the court would call a lot of executive power, that we are going to invalidate these removal restrictions and we will deal with these other things later.
Could this mean the end of bipartisanship at agencies like the FTC?
They didn't spend a lot of time discussing that yesterday, but under the Trump administration's theory, it seems like that could be in jeopardy as well. If the court were to hold in the FTC case that Congress can't place restrictions on when the president can remove someone, that sort of the logical next step would be that it also can't tell the president who he has to put on the commission.
Now, really quick, one more thing, Amy. We also heard about how this is connected to another case about firing Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook. Did Monday's hearing give you any sense of how that case may play out?
It didn't, including because Trump has attempted to fire Lisa Cook, citing allegations of mortgage fraud from before her time on the Fed. So he's saying, in effect, that he has good cause to remove her. Cook has strongly disputed these allegations. One telling sign is that the court has allowed Lisa Cook to remain on the Fed until it hears her case and issues its decision, unlike Rebecca Slaughter.
Amy Howe reports for SCOTUS Blog. Amy, thanks.
Thank you.
Miami is holding a rare runoff election for mayor today. Democrats are watching to see if Latinos in South Florida shift toward their party. From member station WLRN in Miami, Joshua Ceballos reports.
This is the first competitive mayoral race in the city of Miami in nearly two decades. For the past 20 years, the mayor has been voted in without a runoff, and the position has been consistently held by a Latino Republican. But this year is different. Republican and former city manager Emilio Gonzalez faces off against Eileen Higgins. She is a Democrat and has served on the Miami-Dade County Commission. If Higgins wins, she'd be the city's first female elected mayor and the first non-Hispanic in decades. Observers like political analyst Susan McManus with the University of South Florida say this race could be a bellwether for the Latino vote in 2026.
Most outsiders looking in at this, their number one question is the Latino vote noticeably going to switch from Republican to Democrat? And if so, how much?
President Trump is likely to cast a shadow over the local election. He endorsed Gonzalez, who was the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services under George W. Bush. Gonzalez says he wants strict immigration standards.
I'm in support of a border policy. We did not have a border policy.
He is also supporting Trump's move to end temporary protected status, which provides a legal way to stay in the U.S. for several migrant groups, including Venezuelans. Higgins, meanwhile, is critical of policies that led to the development of the ICE detention facility dubbed Alligator Alcatraz, which has been widely criticized for harsh confinement practices.
From Washington and from Tallahassee, there is this culture of trickle-down hatred. We have governments that are building cages for people rather than building housing.
Immigration issues, experts say, are dividing Latino voters in South Florida and may not only influence this mayor's race, but impact midterm elections nationwide next fall. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Ceballos in Miami.
This is NPR News.
Bye.
KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
PR comes from this station and from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. From Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We've been exploring the future of the Democratic Party as it finds itself in opposition to this president. Our next conversation as part of our series is with Chris Van Hollen. He spent decades in state and federal politics. He's currently a Democratic senator for Maryland, and he says his party needs to do more to push back against President Trump's policies.
I'd say we have an incomplete grade. It's a work in progress. Early in the Trump administration, too few recognized the clear and present danger that the Trump administration posed to our democracy.
I asked Van Hollen about a recent Pew poll that shows that over two-thirds of Democrats are frustrated with their party, and that's quite a spike.
Those numbers, when you see them, what do you think your party is doing wrong?
Well, I think we need to do two things. Number one, I think we need to fight back at every juncture and fight back effectively and speak to all the issues that the American people are concerned about. But you're absolutely right. Even though Donald Trump's, you know, approval has gone down, people still don't have confidence in the Democrats as an alternative. And that means we also need to be much more clear about what we're fighting for, not just what we're against. And I do believe it's important that we focus on an agenda that says we'll take on powerful special interests in order to advance the public interest at every single juncture. I think Democrats have become too much perceived as the party of the status quo when people want to see us move in a different direction.
What can your party do now, though? I mean, you basically have no power, and we don't know what will happen in the midterms. What should your party be doing right now when it comes to policies they don't agree with and they don't think help the American people?
Well, we need to resist the Trump lawbreaking at every juncture. I mean,
but like in practical terms, how does that look?
Well, I mean, for example, Democracy Forward is a group. I just met with them again. We work on, you know, litigation strategies. I mean, one of the things that has slowed down, you know, the lawbreaking administration has been these, you know, cases in court. But you're right. At the end of the day, we need to win back majorities in the House and the Senate.
You have had a lot of leadership roles within the party. You were in charge of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in two different election cycles. When you look at both the successful elections and the unsuccessful elections for your party, and you think about messaging, what do you want to see from your party that is different in the run-up to the midterms?
Well, what I'd like to see is an agenda that, again, makes clear what we're fighting against. And, you know, we do have a president who is breaking the law every day in one way or another. My view is that in addition to beating that, we need to put forward alternatives. So, for example, I will be proposing a tax cut for working class people, middle class people who are just making enough income to get by based on the, you know, standard of living. I don't think anybody should be taxed with a federal income tax where it takes their overall income below the standard of living. Those are the kind of things that I think that we need to embrace going forward in this election.
I mean, it's no question that you are a huge critic of this president and his administration's policies, but you've also been open about criticizing your own party. And I think there's no place that it's more evident of fracturing than what we saw during the campaign for New York mayor with Zohran Mamdani, and so many in leadership either didn't endorse him or took a really long time to come on side. What do you think that race and your party's reaction to it from the newcomers versus the status quo says about your party?
Look, I'm a big tent Democrat, meaning we should elect, you know, people in every state. I mean, Joe Manchin was somebody who could win in West Virginia. I didn't always agree with Joe Manchin. And Mamdani clearly, you know, energized a huge part of the electorate. And so, yes, I was disappointed that he did not get the full support of Democrats across the board. I hope going forward, the Democratic Party will embrace these new voices who clearly connected with voters and energized the voters.
And you were much more stringent than that. I mean, you called people who didn't endorse him spineless.
Well, I do believe that if you want to elect Democrats and shake up the status quo, you can't take an a la carte approach, right? My view is if we're going to be a big tent party, we need to embrace younger voices.
Who is your party's leader right now?
Right now, you've got people across the country. These grassroots organizations are those that are providing sort of the fuel to take on and resist this lawless president. The No King's Day was a great example. So I say to people across the country, there's no posse coming, right? I mean, there's no like big, you know, reinforcements out of Washington, D.C. This is a moment where each of us has to use our power in our own ways to fight back. This is a period of sort of building and rebuilding. And I think that that's healthy. I don't think that's a problem.
So really, there isn't a clear leader. I mean, would that become maybe clearer after the midterms? Would you run for president in 2028?
That is not my goal, right? I'm very focused first on the 2026 midterms, but I do really plan to play a big part in the conversation about where our party and country goes. You know, I was invited by the Democratic Party in, you know, Polk County, Iowa, to deliver the keynote at their steak fry. And I really talked about what you and I are talking about, right? The need to more effectively take on a lawless president, but also outline the measures we will take to shake up the status quo and allow the Democratic Party to regain the trust and confidence of the American people.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen, thank you so much for your time.
Good to be with you.
This is NPR News.
In Uganda, a program seeks to address poverty by giving cash and financial coaching to people who need it. Now, funding to global development programs like this are being cut.
If we can find a better way of squeezing more juice out of whatever we're doing, then you can expand and help more people. And instead of going to 1,000 communities, we can go to 2,000 communities.
More on those challenges on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on People Powered, KAXE and KBXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up will be your daily dose of phenology. Got some weather to be telling you about. It's looking like we may be getting some snow and then cold temperatures moving in this weekend. We do have a winter weather advisory that's in effect and that may move into a winter storm watch or warning throughout the day, depending on your location. Slippery road conditions are happening out there, and we're expecting highs 21 to 30, gusty southeast winds up to 25, snow coming in again this afternoon, additional 1 to 5 inches, and evening lows from 6 to 13 degrees. We have a question of the week. We're talking about cookies. I don't know about you, but I made my first batch last night. Is there anything special that you make this time of year? Do you try new cookies? Share your recipes and cookie making tips. Text 218-326-1234. I tried a friend's lemon ricotta cookies that were delicious, actually like a little piece of cake. Let us know. We'd love to hear from you this morning. 218-326-1234. Programming this morning is possible in part by Edward Jones financial advisor, Christina Gallis, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC. Coming up today at 9 o'clock, we bring you Headwaters. Your host is going to be Malachi Coons. And then our volunteer-hosted program, On the River, continues today at 1 o'clock with your host, DJ Ironsides. And tonight at 7 o'clock, it's John Henningsgaard. Also, this morning, we're going to celebrate John Latimer. It's his birthday. Why not hear from John right now with your daily dose of phenology?
On this date, December 9th, 1948, a young phenologist was born into this world in the hospital in Park Rapids, Minnesota. His mother had to wade through knee-deep snow out to the road to get in the ancient Dodge that my father drove to get to the hospital. And once there, I resisted coming into this world as long as I could and managed to let the 8th of December slide by, and then in the early morning hours of the 9th of December, I relented and was born 8 pounds 10 ounces. As my father would like to say, that's a keeper, put him on the stringer. And I've been here ever since, and you know, it's been a pretty good trip so far. Happy birthday, Mr. Phenologist.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters this Friday. From Capital One with the Capital One Quicksilver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump has a plan to give $12 billion to farmers across the country. And Trump said Monday that the one-time payments will come from tariff revenue.
This relief will provide much-needed certainty to farmers as they get
this year's harvest to market and look ahead to next year's crops.
Those tariffs that Trump says are paying for the farm relief are also one of the reasons some farmers are struggling. Another is rising health care costs. Drew Hawkins with the Gulf States Newsroom spoke with some farmers in Louisiana about their concerns.
James Davis is a third-generation row crop farmer in northeast Louisiana. He grows cotton, corn, and soybeans on around 2,500 acres.
Just been farming pretty much all my life.
Farmers have been hit really hard this year, Davis says, even with what he says is the best crop he's ever had. He says the Trump administration's tariffs mean they can't export their commodities because other countries have also placed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. When farmers can't sell their crop and make back enough money, it makes it harder to get crop loans the following year. Davis says the money President Trump is pledging can't come soon enough.
I was in with my banker projecting 2026, and without bailouts, it is hard to make crop loans work on paper. So it's imperative and very imperative that the Trump administration get these payments out as soon as possible.
It's not just crop loans that are harder to get. Davis says because farmers have been struggling to make ends meet this year, it's also harder to pay for health insurance. He and his wife are able to pay for their health insurance because of enhanced premium tax credits through the Affordable Care Act. Those subsidies are set to expire at the end of the month. If that happens, he says the cost for their insurance will quadruple.
That number was like $2,700 per month.
Davis describes himself as a moderate Democrat. A poll released this month from the health policy research group KFF shows 72% of Republicans enrolled in marketplace plans support extending the subsidies. That's reflective of people like Daniel Rhodes, a Republican who uses the subsidies to help him and his wife pay for their health insurance.
There's a lot of people who won't be able to eat that big of a change overnight. I mean, I don't know how people can.
Rhodes lives in West Monroe, Louisiana, a small town surrounded by farmland in House Speaker Mike Johnson's district. Rhodes, a landscaper, says he supports Speaker Johnson's leadership, except when it comes to health care and the ACA subsidies.
This was a big one that I really just took the opposite side of the fence and said, like, look, this is a crazy hill to die on to say we're going to lock up the budget over health care subsidies. Like, man, pick any other thing.
Rhodes isn't the only Republican in Johnson's district who supports extending the subsidies. Susie Halley runs a food pantry in Farmerville in Union Parish. She says local farmers are already struggling to pay health care premiums, and Congress needs to stop playing party politics.
Mr. Johnson, or whoever else, it may be Republican or Democrat, I don't care. Let's fix the problem.
This week, the Senate is expected to vote on a Democratic proposal to extend the enhanced premium tax credits for 3 years. But the plan is not expected to get the votes it needs to advance. Over in the House, Speaker Johnson said recently that he plans to present his caucus with a plan to bring down health insurance costs and adds it's, quote, only our party that is going to bring down premiums. For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in New Orleans.
The Trump administration has a new name for its aggressive policies in the Western Hemisphere, including military attacks on alleged drug smugglers and threats of regime change in Venezuela. His administration is reaching back 2 centuries and calling this Trump's version of the Monroe Doctrine. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie is following all this and is with me in the studio now. Good morning.
Hi, Layla.
Okay, so for those of us who've forgotten U.S. history here, just give us a refresher on the Monroe Doctrine.
So U.S. President James Monroe proclaimed this doctrine in 1823, saying European countries should not interfere in the Western Hemisphere, that this is a U.S. zone of influence. Now, any number of U.S. presidents have cited the Monroe Doctrine. For example, Teddy Roosevelt, who oversaw the building of the Panama Canal in the early 1900s. As we know, the U.S. carried out many military and political interventions in the 20th century, though in recent decades, the U.S. approach has been a little less heavy-handed.
And to say the least, not all of these interventions have been successful. What is Trump's version of this doctrine?
Well, we've been seeing it really since the beginning of this term. He's threatened or imposed actual tariffs against major trading partners from Mexico to Brazil. The U.S. is waging this ongoing military strikes against suspected drug traffickers in the Caribbean and the Pacific. And there's this major U.S. naval and troop presence. It's really the largest in decades, and it's accompanied by threats to oust Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro. Here's Christopher Hernandez Roy with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank.
The use of hard power, the use of economic power to achieve objectives is something that is more consistent with a sort of a Monroe Doctrine type of approach to the region. And I think that's what we're seeing.
And the Trump administration made this explicit last week when it released the National Security Strategy. Now, this document marks a major change in the overall U.S. approach to the world and to Latin America in particular. It says prominently, quote, "We will assert and enforce a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine."
How is the overall strategy being received in the region? I mean, there are the questions of the legality around these attacks, but particularly the idea that the U.S. military might attack Venezuela directly.
Yeah, a Brazil research group, Atlas Intel, recently conducted a very detailed survey across the region and found that 53% of Latin Americans would support a U.S. military intervention. Now, in contrast, polls in the U.S. have found a much lower level of support among U.S. citizens, where there's only around 30% who say they'd support it, U.S. military action. Now, these findings surprised Hernandez Roy.
It kind of flips what you would expect on its head, where you'd think that there would be more support in the U.S. for removing a dictator than support among Latin Americans, given the long history of U.S. interventionism.
So when it comes to Trump's approach to the region, he's also, Hernandez Roy's also made the point that a number of countries like Mexico have opted for compromise rather than confrontation.
Right.
No one really wants to be the country having a showdown with the Trump administration.
You mentioned that the original Monroe Doctrine was designed to stop other countries from influencing geopolitics in the hemisphere. So what's the goal here? Will Trump be able to stop or reverse the influence of powers like China in Latin America?
Well, Leila, that's a tall order. And here's a pretty remarkable statistic. China is now the leading trade partner of every country in South America except Colombia, where it's second to the U.S.
Wow.
China has made tremendous economic inroads with Latin America. Trump wants to boost the U.S. role, but some of his policies can be counterproductive. When he placed huge tariffs on China, China responded by halting the purchase of U.S. soybeans and began buying them in Argentina. So getting tough with Latin American countries could have unintended consequences.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie. Thank you, Greg.
Sure thing, Leila.
This is NPR News.
Sometimes we need a bright spot in our day. That's what you get when you tune in to KAXE.
And our ancestors show us, in the face of incredible adversity, what it looks like to persevere, what it looks like to keep moving your feet forward. You know, Martin Luther King talked about, if you can't walk, then you should crawl, right? But you must keep going. So my encouragement is, you do have an important role to play, and you must not grow weary in doing good. Rest if you must, but do not quit.
It's Minnesota author Sharon McMahon from a KAXE Conversation. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the bright spots that you hear. You can text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234.
It's 5:43. More news is coming up next from Morning Edition. We'll also be bringing you the Up North Report. Local news from KAXE. We're going to be hearing more about the storm warning from the National Weather Service. We'll hear about the Congressional 8th District and the DFL chair and students in Deer River and telehealth. Make sure you stay tuned. We are seeing high winds and possible snow and freezing rain this morning. Roads may be slippery, so take it slow today. Highs 21 to 30, gusty southeast winds up to 25. Snow beginning this afternoon with additional 1 to 5 inches, evening lows from 6 to 13 degrees. We receive support from Beltrami Electric, building an all-of-the-above energy strategy that combines the diverse strengths of sun, wind, coal, and water. Beltrami Electric Cooperative is connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. Students are tracking winter. We'll be hearing student phenology reports coming up before 7 o'clock and before 8 o'clock. And then Pam Perry, non-game wildlife biologist, she'll be talking Christmas bird counts and pine grosbeaks. We'd love to hear from you this morning. What are you seeing at your feeder? Text 218-326-1234. I've been seeing a lot of chickadees and downy woodpeckers and more. We'll talk big weather picture with Tornado Bob coming up at 8:10.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
Anna Mae Martinez in Culver City, California. Indiana University sports fans are experiencing a once-in-a-lifetime season, and it's not for the sport that you might think. The University of Men's basketball program has won 5 national titles, but this year it's being overshadowed by the football team, which is undefeated and won their first outright Big Ten title since 1945. And the success feels like it happened overnight. Here to talk about the program's rise, we've called up Michael Nizelik. He covers Indiana University sports for the Bloomington Herald Times. So, Michael, is the Hoosier State's flagship campus now a football school?
It's getting there. If Kurt Cignetti has his way, it will be in maybe in a couple of weeks, right? he's trying his hardest, and you know he's made promises and cashed all the checks he's kind of laid out there. And this Big Ten title was certainly a huge one.
And Cignetti, that's the coach, and he's really the one responsible for this big change. How was he able to do this?
Yeah, well, he's also kind of the GM, right, or like the talent evaluator in this age of college football with the transfer portal. He's brought in all the right guys, and he does that, too, with the coaching staff. He's got a lot of guys that have been with him going back years, including defensive coordinator Brian Haynes and offensive coordinator Mike Shanahan. Those are the guys he trusts. It all works together. There's a lot of synergy. And then, obviously, the quarterback, he's a quarterback guy. Going back, he's a quarterback's coach. He has that eye for talent. Brought in Curtis Rourke last year, who had success, and now Fernando Mendoza, and it all's kind of gone together.
Yeah, Fernando Mendoza is probably one of the leading candidates for the Heisman Trophy. He had a couple of seasons at Cal, at Berkeley, but what's making him so good this year?
Well, it's development, right? And last year at Cal, he didn't have an offensive line. He was sacked, I think, 40 times, which was tied for the most in the country. He was on the run. You know, Indiana's put talent around him. And then with Cignetti, Shanahan, they've all kind of brought them into their system, got him comfortable, got him reading the defense, that he's got NFL arm talent. They've just put the system around him to unlock that.
Tell us what the atmosphere on game days is like in Bloomington. I mean, how has it changed? It had to be completely different even a few years ago.
Well, absolutely. The stat I like to use is since like 1970 when they expanded Memorial Stadium, they've only had 18 sellouts. 8 of them have been in the last 2 years during Cignetti's tenure. It's completely transformed. He's bought in. You know, he's got the students to buy in, and he didn't like what was happening here. 5 weeks into the system season last year, he told fans they got to show up, they got to be loud, and they got to start staying for the entire game. And they listened. They took it seriously, and he's made an atmosphere, made Memorial Stadium a hard place to play. He hasn't lost there yet. They have the longest active home win streak in the country.
Staying for the entire game. I'm from L.A., Michael. L.A. sports fans don't do that. We got to go to
dinner. Well, they would if he was the coach.
There you go. There you go. All right, so they're the number one seed, which means they have a bye in the first round. So they're waiting the winner of Alabama and Oklahoma. Do you think they have what it takes to at least get past one of those two schools when they play in the college football playoff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they'll, you know, be favored in you know, any game up leading up to the title. I think there could be a rematch in the title game against Ohio State. I think they're in a really good spot. I think people saw in that Big Ten title game, you know, Ohio State was being talked about having the best defense in the country, having this offensive talent. Indiana matched them everywhere on the field. I don't see them being an underdog. I think they're going to be a heavy favorite in that at quarterfinals game, whoever their opponent is.
My colleague Steve Inskeep is from Indiana. He didn't go to the University of Indiana, but I'm sure he's rooting for them in the college football playoff. Michael Nizelik covers Indiana University sports for the Bloomington Herald Times. Michael, thanks.
Absolutely.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
When you tune into KAXE and KBXE, you hear about the things happening in our community, even during the winter. And we love hearing your stories. Maybe you're someone who ice skates. What's your favorite place to ice skate? You can text us at 218-326-1234. We know you're not going to tell us where the walleyes are biting, but there are tons of fun things to do outside in nature. Or hey, give us a recipe. If you stay inside and you are cooking, you are making cookies for the holiday ahead, you can text 218-326-1234. Keep KAXE with you as you go about your winter day. Thanks for supporting KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton.
Does the NASDAQ make you cool?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing direct car insurance rates side by side with other insurance carriers. Customers can see rates and find an option that works for their needs. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Good morning to you. Walmart is moving from the New York Stock Exchange to the NASDAQ market. It's the biggest company to ever make the switch from platforming its stock down on New York's Wall Street to a company with a showroom on New York's Times Square. The thing is, NASDAQ has a cool kids growth through tech vibe, and it's where the stocks of Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Nvidia live. To understand this better, let's bring in Jay Ritter, professor of finance at the University of Florida. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's be fair to Walmart here, right? You think of them as a big box retailer, but they have a sizable online presence that is a stiff competitor for tech company Amazon.
Absolutely. Indeed, because of the growth in their online business and successful competition against Amazon, Walmart is now selling at a higher price-earnings ratio than most of the so-called Magnificent Seven.
You know, it's a popular way to invest these days is to buy the whole S&P 500 index. And so if you're in that index, companies stand to benefit just by virtue of that inclusion. Is there a kind of bump that Walmart might get for being included on the NASDAQ market, which is not an index in itself?
By moving to NASDAQ, Walmart is able to be not only in the S&P 500 index, but also in NASDAQ's QQQ index for the 100 largest companies on NASDAQ. And while not as much money is indexed there as with the S&P 500, some is, and an estimate is another $20 billion is going to be invested in Walmart as a result.
Now, if you go visit NASDAQ, it's computer-driven. You go over to the New York Stock Exchange, it's secretly computer-driven, but there are still some humans wandering around. That's where you still get the still photographs at the end of a bad market day is over at the New York Stock Exchange. Do you think the New York Stock Exchange needs to do some rethinking about its brand?
Not necessarily. There are many markets where the individual stocks get traded. So just because a stock changes from the New York Stock Exchange to NASDAQ where it's listed, that doesn't actually mean that much of the trading volume is going to be changing. It is still the case that the New York Stock Exchange does provide certain certification. And in recent months, NASDAQ has been under a little bit of scrutiny because of a lot of penny stock IPOs that have been listing there, many of which have been manipulated and most of which have crashed and burned.
Jay Ritter at the University of Florida, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, as always.
All right, let's do the numbers. Stock index futures up just a bit. Dow and S&P futures up a 10th percent each. NASDAQ futures up 14 points. That's less than a 10th of a percent. The 10-year interest rate is down slightly, 4.16% now, with the guardians of interest rates at the Fed starting their two-day meeting later this morning. Consumers are feeling worse about their current and future financial situations. That's among key findings from the latest survey of consumer expectations out this week from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Marketplace's Carla Javier reports.
Consumers have greater awareness of what's going on in the economy than they get credit for, says NerdWallet's Elizabeth Renter.
Most of us shop for groceries, most of us buy gasoline, and in that way, we can be in tune with what inflation is doing, even if we're not watching the numbers that come from the BLS.
And with government reports delayed or canceled due to the shutdown, consumer expectations are especially useful, says Justin Wolfers at the University of Michigan.
So in the absence of that hard data, looking instead to how people are feeling becomes all the more important.
And how people feel can actually impact the economy.
If I'm worried about losing my job next year, I might pull back a little bit, tighten the purse strings.
That could affect businesses, which could affect hiring. You get the idea. When Vicky Bogan at Duke looked at the latest survey from the New York Fed, she noticed somewhat mixed findings.
You could say employment expectations improved slightly.
But the survey did show that people think medical costs will increase.
Medical costs are one of the leading causes of bankruptcy for households in general.
Another key takeaway? Consumers told the New York Fed that they expect the inflation rate to remain steady over the next year. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
And the environmental group, the National Resources Defense Council, wants more people to use recycled toilet paper. In its latest scorecard, the group gives failing grades again to some of the biggest toilet roll brands, which are largely made by cutting down trees, often in Canada. The NRDC claims that if every American used just one roll of recycled, 100% recycled, it would be like getting 72,000 cars off the road for a year. Now, Whole Foods and Trader Joe's 100% recycled, among some others, did get A-pluses, and the NRDC praised Procter & Gamble for breaking out of the F category, finally, with its sustainably certified bamboo toilet paper. This is drawn from the NRDC's seventh annual report titled The Issue with Tissue.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by Bitwarden Password Manager. Bitwarden is built to secure online shopping accounts during the holiday season or any time. Learn more at bitwarden.com.
There's a battle brewing over who's going to regulate artificial intelligence. Some states have stepped in, but the Trump administration is now trying to head that off. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
President Trump says he'll sign an executive order this week to establish what he calls one rule on AI. He says too many state rules will keep the U.S. from leading the global AI race. Since there's no broad federal legislation, states have enacted their own laws. The National Conference of State Legislatures says 38 states adopted or enacted around 100 AI measures this year. For example, Oregon prohibits AI from using licensed professionals' titles, such as registered nurse, and North Dakota prohibits people from using AI-powered robots to harass others. It's not clear that President Trump can block these state laws. His executive order could face legal challenges. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Our producers are Tamar Fagan, Ashley Rodriguez, Ariana Rosas, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. Our supervising senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
We've got news headlines coming up from National Public Radio. It is 5:59. Support this morning comes from Itasca Orchestra and Strings Program's Family Christmas, Saturday, December 20th at 4 p.m. at the Rife in Grand Rapids, bringing the snowman to life with a film projection and live orchestra music to accompany. itascaorchestra.org/events. The weather, we do have a possible winter storm watch or warning depending on location. And Arctic air expected later this week. Today, high winds early, temperatures 21 to 30, gusty southeast winds up to 25, snow coming this afternoon again with additional 1 to 5 inches, evening lows from 6 to 13 degrees. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.